They basically created a casino out of our economy. And whose money do they use to play their little games? All of ours. Every dollar, if you trace it back far enough, can be traced back to a municipal fund or something like that. And Wall Street has used it to generate an estimated quadrillion in assets for themselves. Do you know how much a quadrillion dollars is? Imagine you're walking along the beach and there's this beautiful coastline, and that coastline symbolizes money. And you lick your finger and you dip that finger in the sand. The speck of sand on your finger would be enough money to end homelessness. It would be enough money to end poverty. It would be enough money to give everyone health care. But we don't do any of those things. And why? Well, because Wall Street has a hand in defense, agriculture, and pretty much everything else, and they fund both political parties.
Tonight, we're talking to Ron Placone, comedian, writer, podcaster, and now filmmaker, about his new film, Left at Wall, starring Ron himself, Gareth Reynolds, Kimberly Hill, Sarah Kay Godot, and with appearances by Graham Elwood, Eddie Pepitone, and Dave Anthony.
I just can't do this anymore. I think we need a break.
What? Why?
I'm just gonna go stay at my sister's.
How long have you been this unhappy?
A while. Every day I wake up, and you just drain me. And I can't do it anymore. I'm gonna go pack.
Tonight? You're leaving tonight? Like, what? Why? Okay, guess I'm not getting laid tonight.
Left at Wall tells the story of two brothers, John, played by Ron, and Don, played by Gareth Reynolds, who you might know for The Dollop and for co-hosting We're Here to Help with Jake Johnson from New Girl. John is a struggling writer with a temper who doesn't get along with his brother, a douchey Wall Street broker who constantly condescends to him. This bad relationship messes with his family, with his relationship with his girlfriend, and leads John to decide on a plan for revenge, which is going against his brother and Wall Street at large, rallying the GameByte stock that his brother has decided to short, in a satirical parody of the GameStop Reddit moment in 2021. Other movies we've covered on the show have tried to tell the GameStop story. We talked, of course, with Eileen Jones about Dumb Money back in May, but Ron's film manages to take that moment as a backdrop to tell a heartfelt story about family, not letting anger control your life, and the struggle between our ideals and the personal realm, and how easily they can become unhelpfully intertwined. And he manages to do it in a cool 1 hour and 1 minute. The movie is on most streaming platforms right now, Apple TV, Prime Video, and YouTube. It's definitely an interesting premise that suits Ron's progressive politics, and we're happy to talk to him about it tonight.
You're going to propose to Sarah?
Yeah.
When I first saw her, I thought, you are really playing with someone who's far out of your... I mean, she is so out of your league, it's nuts. You're punching way out of your weight class with her. I'm saying, way to go. I mean, that's like...
Thanks.
That's how you do it. I feel like when you go out in public, when I see people gawking and looking, you know, in the way that they look at like reality show winners, you know, they go, you know, the meek person ends up with this sort of beauty.
Yeah. I appreciate that.
That's my pleasure. I'm just saying, I'm speaking from the heart. I mean, you need money or for the ring or the wedding? What's the angle?
Before I introduce the panel, please like this video and subscribe to the Movie Night Extravaganza YouTube channel. Then hit that bell to get notified whenever we're streaming. Super chats are now open. If you have any pressing questions, send us a super chat, which helps me maintain the expenses for the show, which I'm obligated by the rules of the Geneva Convention to stop everything and ask the panel. Another way to help us out is to become a patron and give us money every month. In exchange, you get access to all of our after parties, bonus content, and we'll tell you even more movies we watched recently. Patreon.com/Movie Night Extra. We have a Movie Night Extravaganza Discord. There's an invite link in the episode description, and we have a Letterboxd HQ account, so those are two more places to follow along with us. Okay, let me introduce the illustrious panel. Christina Oakes is a co-host of Movie Night Extravaganza and a Twitch streamer. You can find her streaming at twitch.tv/cosmopolitics. All of her social media accounts are also at cosmopolitics. She's on Twitter, Instagram, and Blue Sky, and even occasionally on Letterboxd. Ron Flacone is an actor, filmmaker, podcaster, and writer. He currently hosts 1000, a show which has him on a quest to interview 1000 interesting people, and he frequently does stand-up. You can find his touring dates at www.ronflacone.com. I, of course, am your host and the guy who would never want to do a virtual dinner with a finance podcaster who lives on a boat, Forrest Miller. Conan is currently on tour, but his album, The Way of the Neutron, was just released on Bandcamp. You should go to neutronfriends.bandcamp.com and order it today. How's it going, Ron?
Wow, thank you so much for making that. That was amazing. I appreciate that a ton. That was really, really cool.
I just whipped it up today.
That's awesome.
I spent the afternoon kind of working on it.
I appreciate it.
Nice. I grabbed the Vimeo file, so I was like, oh, I could just throw whatever on here.
Mm-hmm.
We've been on a kick with say movies should be shorter. So this one's like a perfect.
I got a perfect cool hour.
One time Cone is not here.
Yeah.
No, I agree. Actually, I like when movies are in about like the 70-minute range, and that's why I left it wall.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty short feature, and yeah, I like it that way.
I mean, you know, a lot of times I feel like indie filmmakers end up doing like an hour, and then the hour turns into like something longer their next time they're doing something. But like an hour, I feel like is a great time limit to start out, you know, which I guess my first question. So how long have you wanted to write and direct films?
You know, I kind of fell into it. That's a weird way to put it. But basically, I come from the comedy and podcasting and writing world. And I was writing more and more scripts, pilots, and things like that. And, you know, like you play the LA game, I was getting things pitched and trying to sell things. And a friend of mine who's kind of like an informal mentor to me, like he's not like an official writing mentor, but kind of like an informal one. He told me, and this was in about 2021, you need to write something to make it, and it needs to be bigger than a sketch. Don't just write a sketch, like write something significant, a short film, something. So I kind of thought about that. Then the GameStop thing happened, and I thought it was just so freaking funny when it happened. And so I got the idea very quickly for Left at Wall. I thought, well, what if let's use this as a backdrop, like you put it, and then write a story about some kind of feud. And then I thought about a feud between two brothers, and I just started writing the script. I just thought it was such a cool way to, first of all, like explain how something like that can happen, and then also tell this story about family. And so I just started writing it. I pictured Gareth Reynolds playing the brother really quick. I didn't even picture myself playing John. I didn't know who was going to play John. I entertained the idea that I might play him, but I was sort of open that someone else might play him too. But I started writing that script, and 8 months later we had our first trailer. And, you know, of course there was a lot of space between the trailer and when it finally got out for distribution, between the pandemic was still going on and people had tour dates after that. And there was getting the financing and making sure there was enough financing and team building, and then having to restructure the team because people moved away as a result of the pandemic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it took a while when all was said and done, but we shot it in 2023, did screenings and festivals throughout 2024. And then it officially hit the digital distribution in January. So it's been a little over 2 months now. It was end of January, so just over 2 months.
Yeah, how long did it take you to film the movie? Like, you think an hour wouldn't take many days, but you never know.
We shot it in 6 days, and 3 days it was all in one location, which was actually my residence. And one day we did all the narration to think like part of the premise is that John, the main character, is doing a podcast. He's doing a video podcast. So there was like a bit of a nod there, but he's doing a video podcast in the future and he's telling the story to his listeners. And so that's sort of a backdrop for the movie. So one day we just shot all of that. So it was just me and our team, and we just shot all of that in one day. Then we did all the scenes with John and Sarah that were at home. And then we had the bar scene. That was all one day. Something people may have noticed is that this entire film was not just written to be a micro budget, but it was also written with the pandemic in mind. A lot of scenes are outdoors. A lot of scenes only have a couple characters. A lot of scenes are in very, very simple locations. That was planned because of budget and keeping the pandemic in mind, because I wrote this throughout 2021.
Yeah, I like setting it like right as the pandemic kind of wanes a little bit, right? So you can actually go out. But like so many movies or short movies and like kind of like Netflix, like bigger budget movies, use the pandemic and then dated themselves by kind of having the characters like, oh, we're wearing masks and like taking them off. And yeah. I think that you picked like a perfect time to kind of set it so that it's not like, even though the pandemic's referenced, it's not like, it's not a big part of the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, and plus, we did want to kind of hammer home the idea that it is a fictitious world. Like, we didn't call it GameStop. We called it Game Bytes. It's not Reddit. It's Red Room. And it's a totally different social media platform that doesn't really exist. Well, doesn't exist in the literal sense. And it's also
I figured, I thought that was going to be a copyright thing or something. You're like, let's change these.
that too. Yeah, that too. We also did it for those reasons, but we wanted to kind make it so that it's a fictional world in many ways. So they did have their own version of a pandemic, but who knows if their rules were the same? Like, we don't know any of that. So we kind of played with that.
They had a Flovid, it's like
yeah, right. It was called something else. I think we do still just call it COVID, but yeah.
I like Red Room as a and then they have like Red Rum as kind of a joke with it. I think that kind of creates a very lived in like experience in there.
Thanks.
And I do feel like Red Room would be like a perfect it sounds like something that like they'd be pushing on Twitter. They're like, a new social media experience, Red Room. You go in there and you never know what you're going to expect. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like a cool social, as we were thinking of it and developing it. And then shout out to Colin, the producer over at Status Quo. He did all the fake graphics for Red Room. Well, they weren't fake graphics. They were real graphics. But he did the graphics for the fake website. And he did the graphics for Saber Talks, because that was the vibe we were going for, a YouTuber type vibe. Red Room does seem like a really cool platform. I hope someone out there actually makes it and then pays me some kind of finder's fee.
it reminds me of it's like a YouTube mixed with Discord kind of.
Yeah, it's like a little bit of YouTube, a little bit of Discord,
in my life. Yeah.
So one of the locations, the restaurant with all the clowns, that you have Eddie Pepitone working at. I was wondering about that. Is that like an actual restaurant or that you found or that you like actually frequent or like an actual bar? Is that something that you came up with for this?
No, that is an actual place. That is a place called The Sardine in San Pedro. It is a wonderful punk bar in San Pedro, one of my favorite spots in town. And the guy who owns it, he runs, I think it's a label or maybe they just do distribution, but it's called Resets Ops, and he has a band called Clown Sounds. So that's why there's all that clown stuff there. It's a nod to his band Clown Sounds, which they are actually a very, very good band. And the whole thing with that, some of that stuff was improv, because I basically said to Gareth, I said, look, the whole idea, you know, we were going through the script and the gist of it is this is John's hangout, because John would be into a place like this and his Wall Street douche brother is not going to like that. So Don's supposed to, you know, crap on the punk bar the entire time. So Gareth really played that up. But it was kind of funny because in between takes, Gareth, you know, real life Gareth was just going, this is actually a really cool place. Like, I know it's my job to make fun of it, but in real life, I would totally hang out here. And I'm like, yeah, I live down the street, dude. I'm here all the time. Because it is actually a really badass bar. And then Eddie being the bartender there was just so beautiful. I loved it.
Yeah, I like his, I only have six more sessions of physical therapy song.
Yeah, I mean, he was just cracking people up the whole time. Every single take, he did something, and yeah, it was great.
Oh, wow. Our co-host, Conan, that's in Japan right now, actually looks up, follows the sardine on Instagram.
That's awesome. Oh, nice. Yeah, it's a great spot. I mean, they have some fantastic shows there. And they were, the owner, Todd, was super cool to us. He basically gave us, especially for L.A., a very, very fair price. And he just said, be gone by happy hour. And we were. It was a very, you know, San Pedro is a really tight-knit neighborhood like that. And we totally got the local treatment, which was amazing. He couldn't have been cooler. We were out before happy hour. We had a gaffer kind of make it night. I don't know how, like, super insider filmmaking your podcast is or isn't. But yeah, we had a gaffer come in and make it night. And then we were done by, I think, about 2 p.m. So
yeah, I have a local dive bar, Snug Harbor in New Paltz, where I live, that both for like the college that's in town and for other projects that like the Hudson Valley Film Commission finds, they end up shooting like a lot of the stuff in there, and they're always like, yeah, we'll like either close down for a few hours, or like you do it like, you know, when we don't have a bunch of people there, like during the day. Which is kind of, it's funny that like bars are like, you know what, like we're gonna have people tonight, but like during the day, you're free to, you know,
why
shoot.
Not? Yeah. I mean, it's free money basically. All you have, well, I guess you have to have the electricity on, and it might not have been otherwise, but you're definitely making that back and then some. So, you know, I'm hoping it was a win-win. I think it was. I mean, we left it exactly how we found it. I mean, we had to like arrange a few glasses and stuff. I put it back exactly how we found it. Cause you know, I like hanging out there. I love that place. So yeah, I wanted to treat it right. And I mean, I would want to do that no matter where I was, but you know, especially there, yeah, since it's my hometown watering hole, if you will. So yeah, shout out.
There's like a certain, insecurity to your characterization too, where he realizes that like as his brother, as Don's making fun of, you know, all the clown stuff, you know, you're realizing it's hitting you like, oh wow, there really is a lot of clowns like on the wall here.
And you know, what's funny, I never noticed that in the bathroom just as myself. I mean, as someone who did hang out at that bar all the time, much like John, the character, did, I never, ever noticed that. So yeah, some of that was actually authentic. Like, oh, there is a lot of, I guess they're really okay. And that was, shout out to our DP, Jessica, because that was her idea for that shot. Cause she was looking in that hallway and she just said, I want to do this thing. We have some space. I want to do a thing where you're walking to the bathroom and you're just noticing the clowns, and I have a certain way I want to shoot it. And I just completely followed her lead and just did exactly what she told me to. So shout out to her. Cause that was all her vision. Our DP was so amazing. But again, I mean, Jessica's a punk rocker from Cleveland originally. So, you know, she probably was right at home there as well.
Yeah, it's a good hallway shot. Christina, do you have questions you want to ask? I feel like I've asked like three in a rapid fire succession.
Yeah. What I like about diving into, because one thing that I remember was when the whole GameStop Reddit thing like dropped, and I was like, you mean to tell me that I could have been doing this myself and just scamming? And like, I could have gotten actual money from this. I mean, they tried to recreate that later on, but it wasn't the same because people obviously caught on to it. Was that something that, you know, looking into that, was that something that you can like considered, like, oh, you know, they've done this a few times after they achieved the Reddit's, you know, GameStop thing. But yeah, it's as someone who frequent GameStop a lot during that time, was that kind of weird to do? Like, were you like what was the research process like? Going into like the deep dive, were you like going on Reddit all the time to look into all the GameStop stuff, or were you just reading articles, or did you know anyone who had like hands-on experience with that situation?
That's a really fun question, actually, because there's a multi-pronged answer there. So as far as just the GameStop thing itself, I mean, a lot of that was just watching it happen in real time. And again, I wrote it in 20. Now I edited it many, many, many times, but a lot of the initial foundational ideas were based on what was happening in real time. There were people out there who was claiming it was a hack, which it wasn't. People literally just bought the stock. And I thought that was so hilarious. People on cable news were saying things like this, they hacked it, they hijacked it. They just bought a stock. They didn't break any
law. This is what you guys would do.
Exactly. So I just thought that was so freaking funny. And I had so much fun with it in the script. And I mean, in reality, I mean, yes, it's embellished for the movie, but it's really not much of an embellishment of the things that actually went on. Mm-hmm. Some of the other interesting parallels in the scenes with Dax Murphy, which Forrest, you alluded to that in the in your tweet and in the trailer that you made there. Dax Murphy is a right wing shock jock who Don is a fan of. And Dax Murphy is played by Graham Elwood, who did an amazing job. It was such a funny role for him. He was so good in it.
Because he's such, his like politics are so the opposite of that.
Right. Yeah. Which made it like so fun. And he had a good time with it too. Like, we had a lot of fun with it. One of the cast members is actually meowing. I don't know if you can hear her, but Lucy wants to say hello. And Yay. She, of course, people, I would be amiss in mentioning, she, of course, has a cameo, Lucy the Cat. And yeah. She's in the credits.
She has quite a few, right?
She has a few.
Every time, it's I noticed somebody kind of compared it to, like, Clerks, and the cat shots reminded me of the beginning of Clerks, when the cat's, like, you know, drinking water out of the bowl or whatever, and it just cuts to that, because it's, like, the lo-fi filmmaking of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It was just perfect kind of cut two shots just of the cat. And you know, our editor, Kevin, knows me and knows how much I love cats and love my cat, Lucy. So there was a lot more cat footage that didn't quite make the cut, because it probably just didn't make sense for it to be there. But
we need the cat cut, literally.
We should have some cat
extended version.
there are some things that, like, when he originally first, so John has some bad things happen to him. I don't want to give anything away, but he kind of is disappointed, and he loses work, and he's like day drinking at one point. And we do have a bunch of shots where he's just laying on the couch, kind of passed out, and the cat's just kind of walking on him and whatnot. But yeah, it didn't quite make the cut, but to get back to your research question, another thing I did. So Dax Murphy, the reason I brought that up, the character played by Graham, he's talking about things like how you can evict people during COVID and things like that. He's saying some really horrible stuff to his audience about evil things they can do. And Don's listening to it as if he's some kind of prophet. That is all things that were real. And probably still are real. And the research.
Yeah, I remember that.
Remember that stuff? You know, yeah.
Because like there were so many of those. Because podcasting was, of course, because of COVID, right? Like podcasting was blowing up because it's just something you could do from wherever. And I remember like so many of the crazy right wing, like, oh, this is how you evict somebody. Or like TikTok was blowing up at that time too. And there was like these landlords. And it's still kind of a movement on TikTok. There's like landlord TikTok, where somebody explains to you like how to fuck over your tenants more than you're already doing.
So the research I did, do you remember? And the reason I did it this way, because I thought this will be the really good peek under the hood, because they'll say some stuff that they might want to just say behind closed doors. Do you remember Clubhouse? I don't know if it's even still going. I think I still have it on my phone. But do you remember when Clubhouse was a thing for a little while? And then once things kind of opened up again, it died. I was really active on Clubhouse. I liked it. And there was actually some really interesting stuff on Clubhouse. But there was also a lot of real estate landlord stuff on Clubhouse. And you could just go into those rooms. So I would go into those rooms just as a fly on the wall. And that's where I did a lot of the research to write that character. Mm-hmm. And there literally was some landlord who was saying, people are just throwing away Xboxes and stuff. I mean, that literally was stuff that was going on in a Clubhouse room.
Well, because the stimulus checks during that time, like, you know, like no landlord would have, you know, or like rich kind of guy that was doing that. Well, number one, nobody would have talked about the fact that they were getting way more in PPP loans that most of them never had to pay back. But they'd also, because of the stimmies, they were handing them out, you know, once every quarter or something. And every single time, I remember they would post people on social media being like, oh, look at this person. You know what I mean? Like, they're doing stuff. You know, they're actually, now they're rich. And it's like, I don't think it's a one-time thing. Like, of course you buy an Xbox.
That's not how stimulus checks work. PPP loans, on the other hand. I mean, obviously people who got PPP loans bitching about stimulus checks. I'm like, you don't have to pay those back. Why are you bitching about someone who's getting a stimulus check that they don't have to pay back? Like, shut the fuck up. You got
their loans,
125K PPP loans. Okay, you're fine.
They're loans in the same way that your parent gives you a loan, with, you know, your rich parent or something, and tells you to invest in a business. They're not loans in the way that like payday lender loans are loans, which you know, you got to pay those back on time.
I asked my sister how her stock is doing. She's like, my stock's doing great. I'm investing in crypto. And I'm like,
the whole thing with the Dax character, though, and Don, kind of it hit me hard because I have a little brother who, like, you know, he shares our politics, but he works at like IBM as like, you know, and he does like coding and stuff like that. And at one point, I remember during the early part of the pandemic, I'm pretty sure. I don't think it was earlier than that. He was like, have you ever heard of Dave Ramsey, his financial advice show? And he's like, I've been learning how to invest, you know, by listening to Dave. And I'm like, oh my God, that's terrible. So that, like, that hit me the same way. I'm like, damn, if my brother was like, you know, didn't have like the more progressive side to him, like I could easily see him getting swept up in something like that. I mean, like, I just want dinner with Dave Ramsey, one of those guys.
Yeah, well, and then of course that's sort of the whole experience. You know, Don starts sort of questioning, you know, who he is and what he's doing and that sort of thing.
I mean, you know, it's such a good over the top comedic. How much of that was improv from Graham Elwood? Because I feel like maybe some of that, like, I don't know, like the whole rant that he goes on about cocaine and strippers and prostitutes or whatever in his boat.
Yeah, a lot of it. So most of it was part of the script, but there were like some off the cuff things here and there. And then the thing that you're referring to at the end, we did a couple takes where he just sort of has like it was kind of by the book a little bit. And then he said, can I just do one take where I just go all out? And I said, of course you can. And it was the all out take that made it. And so it's like we basically got the meat, and then the rest of it was just like the all out take, like the, you know, Graham is a crypto guy, so the I should have invested in Bitcoin 10 years ago, that's, you know, that's him.
My sister's the same way. She's like, had invested in like Bitcoin, like I would be a millionaire right now. And I'm like,
I mean you would have if you hit it at the right time, you would have. That was Graham Elwood's let it all loose take. And I just loved it. I mean, I was in the background, you know, because I was in the room with him while he was doing his takes. And I was just laughing my ass off the whole time, hoping I didn't, you know, like ruin the scene by laughing out loud.
the vibe is extremely definitely like Fox News guy that couldn't hack it. Like, that definitely is the vibe that you get out of that, because there's so many of those fucking guys that end up having like a podcast now or like having like a show or something. And it's like, I don't know, like it seems like from the hour show they do or something, it's like, oh, this guy seems like he has it all figured out. And then it's like, yeah, I would not want to meet a single one of those people, like living on a boat or otherwise. Like,
yeah, right. He lives on his yacht. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it was totally just a caricature of that type of personality, which is probably not much of a caricature at all in many cases. I think a lot of those. Yeah. A lot of those people, it really is kind of a sad way to make a living in many ways. And Gold actually had a really, really good tweet about that I think he has since. I don't think he's on Twitter anymore, but he had this really, really amazing tweet about Rush Limbaugh and about how we don't really talk about Rush Limbaugh anymore now that he's no longer with us, because what he does. I think it was a commentary on punditry and that type of punditry specifically in general, where he just said he just sort of angers everybody. It's like a fart in a room that eventually just dissipates, and it just like brings about a bunch of rage.
Yeah, I think I remember. Really, I think I remember nothing. That.
It was a brilliant tweet. It was one of my favorite tweets that I've ever seen.
At least Rush Limbaugh's still sober after all these years.
but that was sort of, I think, yeah, Dax Murphy is that type of person. Like, he doesn't really.
It's such a good name for that guy too, like Dax.
Dax Murphy. Yeah. 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 Well, the whole thing, when I was trying to think of the name for the character, I was thinking, oh, he's going to have some kind of gripe with taxes. That's the obvious thing. So better not tax Dax. It was pretty quick.
Yeah.
And then I thought it made sense for him to be an Irish guy. So Murphy, there you go. So it's like Dax Murphy. I was like, that's perfect for some right.
It's the reverse world. Better Call Saul. It's like,
yeah.
So
how did you come up with the bit where it was, you know, cause I mean, like, do you have kind of a family thing where it's everybody's name kind of sounds similar, or is that like, purely because I liked the because your name is Ron, like I liked the John Don, and then the dad's Ron, like the
yes,
you know, like the mom's Wife's Don, like,
yeah. So that's the one thing that is actually a bit of a nod to my real life. I don't have a brother. People always ask that, which I guess is cool, but yeah, I don't have a brother. I have a younger sister. Our relationship is nothing like John and Don's. We get along pretty well. But the one thing that I just thought was a funny nod to my childhood, and interestingly enough, the only person I think who picked up on it was my sister, because when she saw the movie, she asked me about that right away, is my sister's name is Connie. So when we were younger, it was Ronnie and Connie. And I always thought that was so stupid. Still do. and so I did play with that a little bit. I like being named Ron, but I definitely go by Ron.
And, well, at least you're not named after Christopher Columbus like I am. Or
you're named after Christopher Columbus?
Yeah, oh. I was born on Columbus Day back in 93. I was supposed to be born in
1493.
Like, yeah, exactly. I was supposed to be born around like between Christmas and New Year's, so my parents probably conceived me in late March between their birthdays. And so, but my sister is named after a song about a dead dog named Shannon.
Okay.
So I'm like, great, mom, you know how to, you're really good at picking names. She's like, I didn't know it was about a dead dog. I'm like, yeah, but now we know the type of guy Christopher Columbus is, gonna change my name. Like,
he probably killed a few dogs.
I'm sure he did. Yeah, he did a lot worse than that. Yeah, it's it's funny, as an Italian American, that's always a thing where, like, I've always been loud as long as I've been aware of how terrible he is, because it's absolutely repulsive that there's a name or a day named after that guy, and it's somehow associated with the heritage that I have. And I'm like, why in the world would you, all that guy did, I mean, he did terrible, terrible things to people. He just got lost. He didn't find anything. There were already people there. And he's actually even a bigger moron than people realize. Did you know that people in, I think it was South America, they handed Christopher Columbus this bean and they said, hey, we think there's potential here. Do you want to help us farm these and maybe make something of this? And he said, no, this is worthless, and threw it away, and then probably later enslaved them. Do you know what that bean was? It was a cocoa bean. So Christopher Columbus could have gone down as the dude that brought chocolate to the world. Instead, he went down as a genocidal freaking maniac. So
could have taken the chocolate and gone home.
I don't really think he's really Italian, because we all know Italian names end in a vowel.
Well, yeah, that's another thing. He might not have even actually been Italian. He might have just been financed. Yeah, there. We don't even know. So, yeah, anyway.
He was doing it on behalf of Spain anyway, you know? Like, it's right. Like he was doing it.
Right.
He wasn't even doing it for our people.
We can get off the Columbus thing now.
but I was going to say the Columbus thing as, like, you know, someone who's pretty visibly Italian-American. Like, I always feel the need to explain, like, look, like, the real story behind it has to do with, you know, like, Italians, like, Italian-Americans or Italian immigrants trying to, like, find their place in America and looking for, like, a certain, of course, they didn't pick, like, Amerigo Vespucci, who's, like, another, you know, another explorer that they could have picked that actually did map out the Americas.
Yeah,
yeah,
and it's one of the most beautiful ships in the world, too, like the Vespucci, the Amerigo Vespucci ship. No, I feel you. Well, and the other interesting thing, too, is most Italian Americans, their relatives are from the South, because that was the area that was poor. So those were the people who had to come over. Yeah. So those were the people who hated people like Christopher Columbus. Anyway, it'd be like if years from now we go, you know, 300 years into the future or something, or however many years, and there's people having an Elon Musk day and going, this is our heritage. It's about our American heritage. We love Elon Musk.
South African heritage? Like,
it's the same thing. It's like, yeah, most of your relatives probably hated that guy. Like,
I feel like it's like people from the North that still kind of feel the need to, like, pay tribute to Robert E. Lee. And it's like, he went to war with us. Like,
I saw a few Confederate flags up north, and I'm like, you're not even, I'm like, you got the full-blown accent, you're not even from the South, why are you doing this? You want
a lot of people upstate actually kind of have a weird Southern twang to their voices, and it's like, in upstate New York, and it's like, you're from a different place in America, like, you're not from there.
That's wild. Yeah, I always have pause when I see those anywhere, but especially when it's not in the region you would expect to see them.
Yeah, like why California wasn't even a state.
Yeah, right.
But oh, how did you come up with casting? Like, obviously, you probably didn't really think much about putting yourself, but how did you come up like, oh, Grant would be good with this? And
I got incredibly, incredibly lucky where my entire wish list said yes. When I was writing Don, I just had Gareth in mind for it. I just thought he would be so funny in that role. And he said yes. And then, of course, I thought it'd be funny. Dave Anthony plays his boss. And so I thought that would be a funny Easter egg for any Dollop fans. And Dave was down to do it. Eddie Pepitone as the bartender is just such a no-brainer. I mean, he was so perfect. And then Graham for Dax. And the other roles, I did sort of reach out. Like, I sort of reached out to people. I posted some things on Twitter and Facebook and had, at the time, Zoom auditions, which was more just me going through people's tapes and seeing, you know, when I saw Kimberly Hill's tape, she's just such a good dramatic actor. And Sarah, John's girlfriend, is really the only dramatic role in that entire film. So I wanted somebody who could really bring the drama to the absurdity. So she was just the perfect choice for that and just had exactly what I was looking for in that role. So she was just such an obvious choice for Sarah. And then Tiffany Saber, who is played by, interestingly enough, the actress's name is Sarah. The character Sarah is played by Kimberly, and the character Tiffany is played by Sarah. But yeah, she was just like the perfect choice for that role. And she's become a colleague of mine because she was in my pilot Loner, and then she was into doing Left at Wall. So that was an obvious choice for her. And now we're actually doing a play together. So she's been in just a bunch of my productions. And then the Spikeball team was, you know, my buddy Drew here in Pedro, who's become a production partner as well. And he's in the play now, too. And then it's interesting. out of the Spikeball crew, and there's Anastasia Washington, who is a big scream queen. She does a ton of indie horror stuff, and it's really great. And she was referred to me by a friend, and then we've gotten to be friends, which is really cool because she's awesome. And the other Spikeball player is Nez, who in real life is Drew's fiance now, and they got engaged recently. And in the movie, when John says, "I believe in love," there's a point where John says, "I believe in love." It, and this is just purely coincidental, but it goes to a shot of Drew and Nez, who are together in real life, and they got engaged recently. So I take full credit. No, I'm just kidding. But that's a fun little thing. Like I told him, I'm like, did you guys ever notice that when he says that, it pans to a shot? And by the way, like the editor didn't even know that. Like I don't think the editor even knew that they were a couple in real life, you know? So
there's an intrinsic thing to editing, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
You can kind of zero in on stuff.
Yeah. And then Sally Mullins for the porn star was just a perfect choice for that. She was so freaking funny.
That's such a good bit.
Thank you. That was so much fun doing that with her.
It sold me, I think, on it when you guys get back together. I mean, I guess that's a spoiler, but and then she's like, "Oh man," I forget exactly what she says, but she's like, "They're gonna get back together and I'm still here," or something. And
yeah, yeah. Like, she kinda it breaks the fourth wall where she they get back together, or do they? You gotta watch the movie to find out. Is that where it ends or not?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Speaking of, I don't know. I've gotten a few messages from people messaging me like, "Oh my God, you're over from McClone. He's on your podcast." I'm like, yeah.
I've been following you. I'm a big fan of your tweets and your, well, I try to stay more on Blue Sky, but yeah, I follow you both.
Every time I post something viral, I'm like, wait, how did this go viral? And then it's like, oh, some big blue check Ron Fokowski like retweets it, or Mehdi Hasan. I'm like, oh, here we go.
Yep. Yep.
I got kicked off. Like just as Blue Sky was like taken off, I kicked off Twitter for a year, and then two weeks ago, Elon like finally let me back on Twitter right before. Yeah, I said in the thing I was trying to get my Twitter back, and finally I got frustrated. I said, "Elon, your baby back, bitch, give me my Twitter account back." And then he said your account has been restored, and I was like, "All right, damn." Like,
and it was something that Hasan was reacting to that got you. You know,
I don't know what got. They didn't tell me. They didn't tell me what got me banned. Like, they literally one day I was tweeting about. No, the last time I got banned, they did tell me, and then the time before that, they tell me, and they're like, "Oh, you have to delete this." I didn't get that this time. I just got like "Your Twitter is suspended," and then it automatically would. I don't know if that's because Twitter is broken or whatever, but like it automatically, when you tried to appeal it, it would send you back like "This is suspended," until the one time that I said Elon's a baby back bitch, and they let me back on. So.
So wild. I mean, it's so sad what he's done to that website. Not even just because it's just a Nazi
playground
now. It
wasn't even bad before he came. It was just
it wasn't that bad. Typical
corporate, you know, someone running a corporate, you know, on like that was it.
Yeah, he just made it a million times worse, which we knew was going to happen. It's like all the problems that existed still exist, but they're even worse, and now there are a lot more problems. Like the algorithm, it's basically just useless now. Like you can't, unless you pay, which I mean, it's so funny, like all these free speech warriors who think it's so much better now, like really, like he literally has made money speech that's better to you. That's interesting.
They ignore you if you're like, "I got banned," and they don't say anything back, any of them, because they're like, people don't get banned anymore. Mm-hmm. Twitter's, everybody's allowed on
now. People are bitching about Elon, where's my money? And I'm like, Everything works out for the first few days, but then everything just stops.
I just remember at one point looking at my timeline and I saw slurs that I'd never seen like in the wild before.
Yeah, and that's kind of like, how it was. It's
shit. Like,
yeah. Well, and then the interesting like,
I didn't even know we hated this ethnic group now.
and they're all people you don't follow. It's like, I don't follow any. Why am I getting this in my feed? And it goes, well, because that's the algorithm. The algorithm literally just pumps these far right accounts into your feed, and it's, and people
who upload, you know, child sex abuse material, I'm like, I don't want to see this shit either. Like, get this shit off.
Yeah, but then they keep them on there. They don't ban them for that.
No, they get a warning, but I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever.
It's so crazy. Yeah, it's really sad. But anyway,
we've digressed. We've digressed. And I think you're still in the middle of the answer about the research process for the GameStop thing.
That was basically the gist of it. It was basically the news at large, and then Clubhouse. Those were the big ones. Like, those were the big ones I went to, and then just kind of watching the meltdowns in real time and then writing that script. You did mention Dumb Money. So we do get asked about that occasionally. I've been asked about it a few times, and my response is, I've not seen Dumb Money, but based on everything I know and based on everything that like I've seen the trailer, they are two very, very different movies. Like, their movie is based on the real thing. Ours isn't. So they're very, very different. And I think that...
Yeah, no, it's nothing like... I mean, because we covered it on the podcast.
Dumb Money is them trying to scam the actual system, you know, biographical tale of what happened.
Yeah,
the only thing I would say is, I guess, similar is that movie tries to handle it with, like, a sense of humor, I guess, to it.
Sure.
For like a lot of it. But yeah, they're not similar really at all.
Yeah,
which is totally fine. And so our trailer was up by August of 2021, our first trailer, not the official one, but our first trailer was up by August of 2021. And it was one of those things, you know, Sony, they have people, you know, scour the internet for anything that's similar. So there's no doubt in my mind that Dumb Money knew of our existence, but probably didn't think they needed to reach out because they were just so different, which is fine by me. You know, like I think that's totally fine. You know, whenever I get asked about it, I say, look, they're very, very different movies. We were first. We just didn't finish first because there's Sony and we're not. But you know, there's certainly no, I think it'd be very foolish when that event happened. It'd be very foolish if I thought I'm going to be the only person who ever makes something because of this. I mean, there's because
they did some documentaries on it too. And it's always like, like you say in, you know, this actual movie, like, you know, you're talking about the Wall Street backed, which people on Wall Street did get also money from, like they always play both sides of that. But there's so much Wall Street financing in the movies at this point. And so it's like, you know, it's like watching companies that have invested a bunch of stuff in the movies, trying to tell the story of like this populist moment where, like, you know, these mid-level short sellers basically bested the system. And it's like, how much are you guys kind of just, you know, like doing a little bit of a smear job or putting your hands on the scale a little bit to try to tell the story? Like,
well, yeah. and that's why in Left at Wall, I mean, you know, we are completely, completely independent. And so we really just, you know, used it again as a backdrop to tell the story about the Wall Street machine, which I think is a very evergreen thing, because in reality it's we should not have an economy that works this way. And you know, and all the stuff John says is true. Like, philosophers did warn about doing something like this for centuries. We did it anyway. And
if only Tim Pool could listen to those philosophers.
Well, he's welcome to watch the movie if he wants to. I don't know if he will, but I am trying to get Roaring Kitty himself to watch the movie. I occasionally tweet it at him and email him.
I think he sold his Twitter account or something.
Oh, really?
It was back at one point, and the guy was back on his YouTube channel. But like, he was like posting these weird memes where he's like, you know, stonks are going up again, and it's like, I don't know.
I don't know if it's actually him.
People were asking at the time if it was him, and then I don't think the guy even posted a picture of himself. He's like, it's me, I'm back.
Your next movie should be about, you know, a billionaire racist buying a social media platform and just explaining, this is not a good idea. Look what's happened to it.
Look what's happened.
And his socialist brother.
And his socialist brother.
Actually, that would be. If Elon's socialist brother would be a good.
That would be a fun. Movie Kendall? Premise.
Kimble Musk. What Jeffrey date? Epstein associate, Kimble Musk. Yeah. I remember when the whole GameStop thing happened. It was like 2 months into, like, because I had edited for Michael Brooks, you know, while he was alive. and I was never like an on-screen kind of presence that I had to actually like, because I was just editing the clips and I was putting stuff, like uploading stuff, and I started editing and then producing Give Them an Argument, like Ben Burgess's show. And it was like 2 months after that, the GameStop thing happened. And I was like desperately trying to find like clips and all this stuff to like explain it, or like at least be able to like coherently talk about it. And I can't even remember if I did coherently end up trying to talk about it. But
it was just all of a sudden one morning, it was just everywhere. And yeah, it was hilarious. And I was responding to it in real time. I actually remember it was so random. I had, do you remember, I don't think he's not super active online anymore, I don't think, but do you remember Justin Jackson? He's a NFL player.
Yeah, the football.
Leftist. And he was doing a lot of podcasts back then. And he was on
Katie Halper's.
He
was on Katie Halper a bunch of times when I was working for her.
Yeah, and he was on mine like the day it happened. Like, we weren't planning on talking about it, but it was just so everywhere that we had to talk about it. So we were just responding to this GameStop thing in real time, and it was just so, the whole thing was just so freaking hysterical. And yeah, and then all of a sudden it just sort of, they stopped talking about it real quick because they didn't want to, because they ended up trying to, I mean, they sort of put the, they didn't shut down the app, but they limited the app for a while.
Yeah.
Like, they wanted to do what they could to make sure nobody does something like this ever again. And I think they wanted people to not realize it's something they could do. So, you know, that was the real interesting part.
It was that Robinhood app, which was owned by the same Wall Street brokers, pretty much. That
right.
Like, they were heavily invested in the companies, the same Wall Street brokers that were, you know, like actually trying to short GameStop. Right. Like, so that happened, and then they shut down. Nobody could put money, like, you keep your money on it. But they shut down, I think, everybody's like access to it or whatever. And I remember people realizing, like, in real time, like, maybe this app is owned by Wall Street people.
Yeah.
Like, yes, they're not just letting you into the fucking casino out of the goodness of their hearts. Like, you're being led into the casino by people that are trying to get you to put money into something that you may make a little bit of money, but like, it's going to be minuscule amounts. And watching people realize like how rigged it was in real time, I mean, there's probably like, you know, people on, but the people that were like shorting it too, some of them, like a lot of them were like people that were smart enough to be brokers, or like, I mean, you don't have to be smart to be, but like, you know, like people that were go-getters enough to be brokers, but not allowed onto like Wall Street for whatever reason. And it's like, it was like kind of people trying to break into Wall Street, which I always think about.
And that's the interesting thing of all this, is like the rules aren't the same for everybody. Like it really is a completely rigged game, and it doesn't provide any value. And when you look at it, it's just such a flawed way to do an economy, to have an economy. And it's funny, there's another colleague of mine, and this was all around the same time. And he's kind of very guarded about his personal life. So I'm not going to say the guy's name, but he was meeting with me to try to make an educational series just about Wall Street, just teaching people about what Wall Street really is and what it does. Cause he used to spend time there, and then he had a change of heart. So, you know, there was also that backdrop going on. And when this GameStop thing happened, I just thought, oh, wow, this is so perfect. And I actually reached out to that person first, and I said, this is an opportunity. You want people to kind of have an eye-opened moment about Wall Street? What if we did something like a movie? And then he just never got back to me. So I thought, well, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
So I mean,
it pops into the zeitgeist at these weird times. I mean, like, obviously, like, Occupy Wall Street, right? Like, there's this big moment where people kind of were realizing how rigged everything was, and they were trying to kind of democratize the economy, which I feel like in some ways a lot of bad came out of Occupy Wall Street too, because it's like these terms like democratize. Well, yeah, him too. But like these terms like democratize, or like this more like horizontal way of kind of like protesting stuff that like every single person has to talk. Like, I feel like it's a very bad system for actually getting any change done. You know, like they actually had like a pretty, like, I can't remember, I think it was Jesse Jackson or somebody went down to, I think it was Jesse Jackson wanted to speak, and because one person didn't want him to speak in the entire crowd, he couldn't speak because of that at Occupy Wall Street. Like, there's a lot of, like, I feel like counterproductive forces, including Twitter, that came out of kind of that Occupy moment. You know,
imagine not allowing Jesse Jackson to speak.
It's just, I don't know. I feel like it's like in the zeitgeist. And then this is another one of those moments where it's like, maybe not in the most productive way, but it can be used to educate. The same way that, you know, something like Occupy was definitely educational for a lot of people. And the fucking 2008 financial crash was like a seminal moment for a lot of people. Like, these moments really pop in. And the crash
we're going to have sooner than later.
Yeah. yeah. It is interesting. We're talking about Wall Street on a day like today because it's just, I mean, that's, you just realize how it's just so dominant and it affects everybody's life. I mean, it does. If you don't have any stocks or whatever, it still affects your frickin' life.
Yeah,
it still affects your life big time.
I hate when right wingers say like Social Security is a Ponzi scheme and they should invest in a 401k. I'm like, but here's the problem though. If you put one penny towards your 401k and that's it, you lose the entire 401k. Like, it doesn't, like, you don't, that's not a wise decision. Also, you're allowing brokers and bankers making all these decisions for you and they take. So it's like, you really don't end up having anything unless you're very smart and know when to pull out, so to speak.
Literally. And yeah, I mean, you need to be smart about it. And it's also, you know, it's very hard to avoid because you might have a job where that's your only option to save for retirement. I mean, it's really, really a horrible system in so many ways. And I think what I'm doing with this movie or try to do with this movie is just tell a story about how, hey, there's no ethical consumption under capitalism, so don't take it out on your family. On the same note, though, just because there's no ethical consumption under capitalism doesn't mean that's an excuse to not try at all. And I think that's really sort of the dynamic of those two brothers. Like John, you know, I mean, obviously John's politics pretty much mirror my own, but what I want people to kind of get is that the way he channels those frustrations isn't always productive, you know, the way, you know, he has a temper.
Yeah. And I appreciated that about the movie, because I've had that, you know, like the malaise, I guess, or the rage, or like whatever it is that you've like, you know, the politics kind of reflect the mood, right? Like, it's like as things get even more disillusioning, like you feel even more disillusioned. And then the way that you end up kind of taking it out on the world, or the way that you end up, you know, responding to the world, right? Like, the politics become personal. And it's really hard not to, especially in a situation where, you know, the individual person, because we're not like people in power, and because we're a small, you know, we're a small political grouping, like, it's hard to find a place that it really feels like you're productively working this out. And it's like, of course, if you have a like a family member that has the money, you're like, I'll be mad at them because at least they have to respond to me. They have to answer the phone. You know what I mean? Like, so that part of it definitely resonated. It's like, you know, take it out of your like Wall Street brother, but it's like, that's not a productive way to, doesn't change anything. That guy's definitely not like the head of Wall Street. You know what I mean? Like,
right. Yeah. I mean, he's still just navigating the same system we all are. And at the end of the day, you know, and again, I don't want to spoil anything, but, you know, John finds out that taking things out on his brother actually only hurt the two of them. At the end of the day, those were the only two people that were hurt by it, the two of them, and I guess maybe the rest of their family. So, you know, there's a life lesson to be had there. And I think at the end, they both better each other. I don't think that's really a spoiler, but it's like, you know, that they each teach each other something essential.
Yeah.
But it was kind of rough getting there. I mean, in a lot of ways, there's a certain sadness to their story. And I wrote it that way intentionally. And you know, people have asked me, they're like, well, is that autobiographical? Because it seems pretty on the nose. And like I told you guys, it isn't. But what I will say, a lot of the dynamics between them are based on people that I know. Not like that specific experience of, oh, a Wall Street brother and a writer brother, but just the butting heads, the arguments, the for instances, a lot of those are based on people I have encountered in my life, siblings. And I guess maybe I would notice it and feel sad about it. Like, I would think this is really sad that, you know, this is your sibling and you guys have this type of relationship. You know, it's a bummer. So I would never say who those people are, you know, but they are people in my real life.
It's funny because my sister and I, we have a 7 years age gap. So it took us a long time to actually do stuff together because literally I couldn't do anything with her until I was like 21 because she was well into adulthood and stuff like that. So it's like, yeah, we get to drink or whatever. But her politics, she was a big Clinton fan, like big on Bill and Hillary, but she accidentally voted for Trump in 2016.
How she's do like, you do vote? That?
She's like the voting machine. Every time I kept pressing Hillary. It pressed on Trump instead. And she was
okay.
I'm like,
that's
okay.
Like the
she should have talked to somebody.
It's like the joke in The Simpsons where Homer keeps pressing the button and he's for Obama and it keeps going, McCain. He's like, I only meant one of those votes for McCain.
But if there's one thing, as she's a teacher, her school is not closing down, thankfully. Also, she's got tenure, so she could go wherever she wants to go. But she's slowly becoming more radicalized and not as moderate as she would appear. I mean, when it comes to the economy, she's a little bit more like she thinks that the stimulus checks cause inflation. I'm like, I don't know about that. But like when it comes to like human rights and what's going on in, you know, in Palestine, and she's like she watched me watch Hassan. She's like, is this Hassan? I'm like, yeah. She's like, yeah, I get it. He makes sense. And I see the appeal. I'm like, oh, of course you see the appeal. Like, I guess. But like, it's like, you know, it really takes, you know, some time for people to really see what's going on in the world, for people to realize, oh, we are so fucked and we got to start taking care of each other and trying to figure out what to do about this whole situation.
Yeah. I talked about this on our last episode, but I was rereading Thomas Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas, where he talks about Kansas politics and the fact that the more like people in Kansas, like
Sam Brownback,
which has some of the the more that like they get kicked around in Kansas, like the more they help fucking billionaires and like, you know, vote for the Republicans, and they were voting for like George W. Bush. And it's like, it's so hard to get people to be like, hey, maybe, you know, maybe abortion isn't like the main problem you guys should be focused on, and maybe it's like, you know, kicking around politicians. But we've lost like the history of like American radicalism, really. Like the educational system has gotten so kind of you know, squeezed out that people don't even know about like their own, you know, their own history at all.
Oh yeah. And speaking of Thomas Frank, who I love, by the way, but if you read The People Know by Thomas Frank, every time you hear the phrase right wing populism, you will want to scream at the top of your lungs.
Yeah.
Because it's a history of what populism actually was and still is. And it's right wing populism. It's like saying wet fire. It's not a thing. It is not a thing.
Well, so much of the in that book, he goes through it, but so much of like their demands actually got recognized by the New Deal. Like, you know, they eventually actually did get, like, it's like it's playing the long game, you know, thinking in decades instead of years. That book's really good, though. I made a documentary for Jacobin that was like on that, but it's like Thomas Frank talking, and then it's like, you know, we covered it with different graphics and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, nice.
If I'm not mistaken, Kansas is one state, like probably maybe like the only state that doesn't do the whole thing where it's like, you know how a lot of southern states, red states, mooch off of like California, New Jersey, and New York. I think Kansas is the one state that doesn't do that. So that also kind of ties into their financial situation, where they don't get like taxpayer funds to like from other states to help fix it. But also too, Sam Brownback completely destroyed that state when he was governor. And it hasn't really fully recovered because they keep voting for, you know, the wrong types of people, focusing on the wrong issues, when they should be like trying to figure out how to fix that state.
Yeah, well, that's literally what I mean. What's the Matter with Kansas is about, and it's I mean, it's written in that perfect like Thomas Frank cadence, and like there's an audiobook version where it's him reading it, and he does it in the perfect like kind of slow, but also like, I don't know. He has this like such a cool thing to his voice,
man.
Yeah,
he's such a cool guy. He's a big music guy. Do you know that about him?
I didn't know that about him.
Yeah, he's
we're like Facebook friends, but I don't think he posts there.
I guess I'll do a shameless plug for something. My podcast 1000 with Ron Placone. I do interview Thomas Frank, and so he. You know, the whole point of that podcast is it's sort of a deep dive interview because they're one and done. It's 1,000 different people, so no one gets repeated. So we kind of dive into some stuff he doesn't talk about as much, like his history with music and other cultural things he's into. And we talk about the work, too. but you know, we kind of dive into the man behind the work a little bit more than he typically does. So it's a lot of fun if anyone's curious.
He wrote about, I mean, in that book too, he wrote about like punk bands from yeah. Kansas. So that makes sense
yeah.
to me.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's a big punk rocker, dude. Yeah, he used to run a zine and stuff, and he has a lot of takes on like the 90s and whatnot. It was so cool to talk to him about all that. Yeah, he's a good dude.
But Thomas so Frank. Like the but like where I was kind of going with that is, you know, like the thought I was having with it was like, you know, the idea of like sticking it to like the rich or sticking it to the wealthy. Like there's such a strange dynamic now in American culture where people don't need like voting for Trump is a perfect example, right? Like, oh, you're gonna vote for a billionaire to do things to help out like working class people, right?
I'm like, no, there's no such thing as a billionaire who's an outsider. I mean, he's a man that he's bought politicians himself, so I'm like, that he's not an outsider. He's always been very much entrenched into politics. So where did that come from? I don't know.
Yeah, the people who think that what's going on now is some sort of outsider thing, it's completely delusional. Now, it is a coup. It is a straight up, you know, right wing fascist coup, which I think a lot of people realize because our system's not great. We've talked about all that. The system's super not great. But when you get people who want to make it even worse, that's not a good thing. That's not going to make anything better. And that's what they want to do. They want to all the really, really bad things. They want to keep them going and they want to replace everything else with something even worse. So that's kind of going the other way.
Yeah. Well, there's a cultural anger to all of that where it's like, and I mean, this kind of ties into the same thing with, you know, your film and the personal anger, right? Like the counterproductive personal anger. It's like things aren't going well in your life, you know, for capitalist reasons, not for, personal or whatever reasons, but this anger that kind of exists for a lot of people. It's like someone like Trump, they're like, well, at least he can, you know, knock down the Jenga tower. And it's like, yeah, but if there's nothing to, if you're not building a new Jenga tower, right? Like if you're not building something out of that, like it's just going to be, we're just going to be immiserated. It's just going to be like Russia in the 90s. Like it's not going to be, you know, a new thing where it's like, oh, this is like this is something cool that's going on that we're going to rebuild everything from here. It's like, no, you're going to be in the rubble at the end of that.
Yeah. There's a book called Anatomy of a Revolution that really breaks down how, you know, status quo shifts happen. And even though it was written a long, long time ago, it's still completely applicable today. And, you know, when you read that book and you see how it really goes down, when, you know, the cliff notes is when a status quo is clearly broken, you can either have a turn for the better or a turn for the freaking worst. Mm-hmm. And we unfortunately got the latter. I mean, we got a turn for the worst. That's why, I mean, I really feel 2016 was a once in a generation or multiple generation opportunity to get Bernie Sanders as president, and we lost.
Yeah.
And that was big. I mean, that was just huge. And they were never going to let Bernie be president. But
no, not even in 2020 when he was gaining all that momentum, and Obama was like, I feel sorry for my friend Biden. We're going to put a stop to that.
Yep. And that was just,
and because
country
of that, look where we are now.
Exactly.
It's the same cycle every time. A Democrat gets elected because people hated what the Republican does, but the Democrat does very little harm reduction. And then things don't end up well because we're still living in the Republicans' economy. They elect someone like Trump again, thinking that it's all Biden's economy. I'm like, no, Biden was still living under Trump's economy. An economic cycle for a president usually lasts for like 6 to 8 years, give or take.
Well, basically, it's like the country wanted, I mean, and honestly, it gets back to populism. The country wanted a real populism turn that was denied. So they took their chance on a fake one.
Yeah.
And that's where we're
cultural,
at.
And cultural
this has happened
populism
throughout history. You know, this isn't the first time something like this has happened. And
that's where the Thomas Frank thing, I think, is a good guide to it, because he's talking about like cultural populism versus economic populism.
Right.
And it's like this is the cultural populism of like, you know, giving the entire you know, people like some red meat. Like I remember today I was looking at my Twitter timeline, and literally instead of talking about, you know, the tariffs that everyone's freaked out about and like the recession, every conservative media figure, which I get now in my timeline because Elon, you know, puts every fucking conservative media figure in. If you have like vaguely left politics, he's like, oh, let's add some conservatives to your timeline. And they're all talking about how a black kid apparently stabbed a white kid or something in Texas. And they're like, you know, it's just the most racist shit I've ever seen, being like, you know,
where's
this kid,
the outrage? This, and I'm like, was he killed by a cop? No.
But it's very clearly like a cultural, just cultural red meat to try to distract like all of the, you know, the truckers and fucking union people that ended up voting for Trump that are going to get fucked by what's happening right now and are probably nervous about it. But it's like, why don't we give you a nice little calming, calming tonic? What about also, some racism? We can throw in there.
I also think Fox News got rid of their like stock, you know, like market tracker because of how bad things are. And I'm like, and they're still arguing why tariffs were a good idea. And I'm like, are they though?
I mean, a lot of people are talking about like how targeted tariffs would have been a good idea if you have something behind it where you're like, hey, maybe we could do some targeted stuff and then build manufacturing at the same time. But it's like, I don't even know if that's a good idea.
Or
at this
build
point.
The manufacturing first and again, have a strategic plan. Tariffs are a tool that have been around for a long freaking time. And are there situations where they make sense? Absolutely. Do they make sense in this scenario? Hell no. Hell no. We don't have anything in place, like just nothing. And if we were to have some huge manufacturing resurgence, which is just not going to happen in this country, but if it were to happen, it would not look like Detroit in the 60s and 70s, where you have powerful unions and a strong middle class. It would look like the kids in the coal mines. That's what it would look like. Like we're not talking
already,
wages. Why do you think
labor's
he's going
back?
Yeah. Well, why do you think he's it is. I mean, that's why he's going after labor simultaneously. Why do you think he's gutting labor protections while doing this? So the people and
deporting
even seen,
all the immigrants to that labor we depend on. So that's why they're getting like children to do all the work for them. I'm like, you guys screwed yourselves up with that one.
They were. I don't remember if it was 2 years ago, I think, where all of these different states were gutting their child labor protections. And it's like, oh, well, we're going to let 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds work again. And of course, like the way that like Republicans are very good at framing for, you know, at least if you're
a
person listening to them. It's but they're like, you know, we're doing this for like the teenager that wants to work after school hours at something. And what they're really doing it for is like, you know, the immigrants that come in here.
Yeah.
Well, no, they're doing it for immigrants that come in here and work at like the factories and at slaughterhouses that they want to let work at slaughterhouses at like 14 years old for, you know,
but
for nothing.
But yeah, that's the thing. And people don't realize it's not the fault of the immigrant that comes in here for the work. It's the people who hire them, willing to give them no benefits, no good pay, not a damn thing. Like it's not the immigrant's fault. It's the white
we're gonna make
lie.
Child labor
but
great
it's
again.
It's easier to blame the people with no power. It's easier to blame. I mean, immigration has been an easy scapegoat for generations, and that's not going to change.
I know exactly what could have been done as soon as Trump got elected. And in the state of New Jersey, did this. All the illegal immigrants who work, like did like a strike for one day. New Jersey's everything had to shut down because New Jersey's economy really much depends on those immigrant workers. And my sister was explaining it to me, and I'm like, that's what they should be doing in the entire country. Just don't show up.
Oh, we should have a general strike. Absolutely.
Especially for those workers because they're the backbone.
It's just hard to pull that off in this country because we don't have any type of structure in place to make that. A viable thing that people are willing to do or able to do. And I mean, when you're paycheck to paycheck and you're one paycheck away from not being able to, you know, feed your kids or get them their medicine, you're not thinking about going on strike. You're just in survival mode. And it's by design, like it is by design. And it goes into, there's so many factors at play. And also part of it is just our attitude towards just our work culture and things like that where, oh, it's a right to be working at this is a sort of weird for instance, but I have family over in Italy. And I'm not saying like Italy's some utopia. It's not, there is no utopia, but But it's funny to me when people always talk about the youth unemployment crisis that is in places like that. And the truth is, yeah, there are less jobs for like young people who want a summer job or something. There's not as much of that over there. And then you hear people in the United States say how there's just no opportunities over there. There's no quote unquote opportunities. And I was reading this one thing online where this family was going to move to Italy from Iowa, but they didn't because they were just so distraught at the idea that their kids couldn't have summer jobs in fast food or something like that. Mm. And I just kind of thought, I was like, okay, so you think that a summer fast food job, which nothing wrong with working in fast food, I'm not being disparaging, but you know, I guess it all depends on how we define opportunity, because when I think opportunity, I think the fact that, a kid in Italy gets to go to college for free. A kid in Italy, it's like I see that as an opportunity. They never have to worry about healthcare. I see that as an opportunity. And to me, that opportunity is a little bigger than they're going to have a hard time finding a summer job. I would have people argue with me about that online. And I was just thinking, okay, so my one, I got to tell you, I think you have a point, because I'm in touch with my Italian cousins and we talk all the time. One of them is an attorney who got to go to school for free. One of them is a successful businessman who got to go to school for free. One of them is an engineer who got to go to school for free. But every time they all say to me, Ron, you know what? I just really feel like my life would be complete if I could have scooped gelato more when I was 15 years old. I'm just so heartbroken that I didn't get that opportunity. I would have traded it all
who needs free college when I could have served fries to somebody?
We're such a backwards society in so many ways. And it's by design. I mean, it's 50 years of anti-union brainwashing, 50 years of more than 50 years of pull yourself by your own bootstraps. And people just bought it and they're continuing to buy it. And I think the one kind of okay thing about what's happening now is that maybe more and more people are finally waking up that's not the way to be, that this isn't, you know, we're not the bright light on the hill. And I'm happy to do my part by making anti-capitalist movies that are that kind of soften it with a story about family that's relatable and funny.
Yeah. And I definitely recommend people go watch this, the movie Left at Wall. It's good. I wanted to know when it comes to scripting. So this is, I guess, I don't know if Christina has other questions. This is the last one I had written down. Like breaking the fourth wall, right? Like, how do you decide how much is too much to do that? Or like how much, you know, because I've seen a lot of things like the meta thing, right? Like you watch something on Netflix, you watch something like this is a good amount of kind of fourth wall breaking. But I've noticed as kind of that meta style of writing gets more and more things, like it's really out of whack with how much some stuff has people either breaking the fourth wall or has these interesting like pseudo documentary things. And I think it's well deployed here. So I was wondering about how do you decide on that?
Well, when I wrote it, I knew that I wanted it to be a narrative. And then the idea for making it John's doing a podcast, that actually came later. Originally, it was just written as if it was a guy talking to the camera, kind of like a high fidelity type narrative type thing. But then I got the idea of, it would be really funny if he's doing a podcast. So that actually did come later. And then obviously, like I had the podcast set up, so we literally just made the fake graphic, put it on the screen and whatnot. So there's that element. And then there's a particular element where he breaks the fourth wall when he gives a line. I won't give it away, but he does break a fourth wall very deliberately in a fairly serious moment. And that was A, wanting to soften the serious moment, and B, again, I just wrote Left at Wall as an absurdist, self-aware comedy. Like a quirky comedy, like people compare it to Clerks and stuff like that, which I think is a fair comparison that I'm actually very flattered by. So like all that was in there. And as far as is it going to be? I mean, I did that you know, the one particular part where he breaks the fourth wall. I did that take a couple times, and we just sort of were like, okay, if it really comes across as too over the top, we're just going to cut it. If it doesn't, we're going to keep it in. And we, you know, we decided to keep it in because, you know, when you have moments like that, you can always cut them pretty easily if you need to.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, especially when it's, you know, direct to camera, you can be like, you know what? Maybe we shave this down.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think it's well deployed here, especially when it's like the one moment that really breaks the tension of the scene between him and his brother on the phone. So that definitely was what inspired me to ask that question. But do you have anything you want to plug?
Left at Wall.
Yeah, of course.
Guys, please, first of all, thanks so much for having me, and thanks so much for that trailer. It was freaking awesome. That was so cool.
We should have you on again to do a movie, you know, that's like we usually have guests either pick a movie or sometimes we pick a movie and we're like, hey, you want to come on for this? But we should definitely have you on to do a movie that, you know, that isn't your movie that we can kind of
I like what y'all do, and the reason I like it is I'm making movies now myself, but also because I do feel like there's so much space for more storytelling and, you know, left wing ideas. Like I really feel like there's not as much of that, and I think there should be more of it. I think there should be more, you know, people doing what Adam McKay is doing and stuff like that. And I'm trying to do that. I mean, that's what I'm doing with Left at Wall. And I already got my next production is already being launched as a stage play and a feature film. And it's all about healthcare. So, you know, Left at Wall really took a shot at Wall Street. This next one really takes a shot at healthcare. And by the way, we were rehearsing it right before Luigi happened. So Luigi was interesting timing there. Because at first we were like, well, people aren't talking about healthcare as much. And then Luigi happened. It's like, oh, people are talking about healthcare again. Oh, yeah. But yeah.
I noticed there was a moment where even like Bernie stopped talking about healthcare for a second before the Luigi thing. And it's like, oh man, nobody's talking about it.
No, I mean, and that was part of the reason why, you know, I wrote this next, it's called Termination Fee, and it's actually launching at the Hollywood Fringe in June. But and then the movie's gonna come later. But yeah, I mean, I wrote it for that reason. I'm like, we got to get healthcare back in the conversation. But then Luigi did. Luigi allegedly did. So I'm still not convinced.
Yeah,
we don't need.
Yeah, I'm not.
We don't need to go down
I'm a little bit of a truther because.
Yeah,
I'm not convinced.
It doesn't look like him in the freaking footage.
Yeah, it doesn't. Like, he has different. He trimmed his eyebrows. He was like, yeah, I gotta. And like, also he did it so carefully. It was such a perfect, precise hit. And then he's walking around with the gun a week later, and his manifesto just happens to be in his backpack.
It doesn't make sense. It also doesn't make sense. Why wouldn't? So he's in New York City. Why wouldn't he have gone towards the Canadian border?
Yeah, why, like a lot of people were saying, like, "Oh, that man's gone. He ain't coming back. We ain't gonna find him."
but he's in Altoona. I mean, it doesn't. Yeah, there's so many things. No, granted, it could be totally legit, and he was just, you know, kind of manic or just whatever. I'm not saying totally definitive, but I have so many questions. I am not convinced.
We've never even heard him talk about it. Everything we've heard about it comes from like the NYPD being like, this is what he said. This is the manifesto.
This is what he said. This is what we found.
Totally, yeah.
and cops have never lied before.
Like,
wait, what?
I mean, that's it was pitched as a make or break moment for the Adams administration in the city, right? Like, they're like, oh, if he doesn't find this, Eric Adams is cooked. And then they're like, we found him. Don't worry. Like,
yeah.
You know.
Wink, wink. Yeah. No, I am not convinced at all. I am not convinced at all. Yeah. So the Luigi happening, I don't know if Luigi did anything or not, but the Luigi happening, you know, certainly brought healthcare into the fold. But yeah, Left at Wall, you could check it out. It's on Apple TV. It's on YouTube Movies. It's on Amazon Prime. It's on Xbox. It's on Google Play. It's on demand, a bunch of platforms that I'm not even super familiar with. You can go to my website, romplicone.com, if you're not sure where to get it. But basically, if you type in Left at Wall on your device or your smart TV, or even on YouTube. You can find it. You can rent it or buy it. You can get it on DVD if you're a physical media person. You can buy it on DVD. And if you're confused on where to get any of those links, you can get all of them right from my website, romplacone.com. There's a Left at Wall section, so you can check it out. Please check it out. I'm really proud of this movie. I want the world to see it. I love talking about it. It's my first movie, so I still get kind of like just giddy and excited, and I'm worried I'm gonna forget to thank everybody. Like, I'm worried I'm gonna like forget something prominent and then feel guilty later. So I will just say our entire team was absolutely incredible, and I'm so indebted to everybody, and I appreciate everybody so much. Everything from the amazing musicians that you know, were so gracious in letting me use their music at a very, 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 very reasonable price, and all of the you know, people who helped out with the graphics, our crew, our cast. Just I'm so grateful for every single person. And yeah, so check out Left at Wall. I think you'll love it. And if you do love it, please leave a wonderful review. If you don't love it, please just email me hate mail instead. If just leave it just for me. But I think you'll dig it. It's a, if you like fun comedy movies that call out the Wall Street Machine at the same time, I think you'll dig it. And you can catch me on tour. I don't know when this drops, but I'll be in San Diego this weekend, April 4th and 5th. Oh wait, we're live, aren't we? Okay.
Yeah, so, we're live right now.
Well, whoever's seen us live. I'll be in San Diego April 4th and 5th. And then I'll be in Seattle on May 23rd. And then for anyone in LA, my new play Termination Fee is going to be part of the Hollywood Fringe in June. And that's going to be throughout the entire month. We got 5 performances. I will officially list those dates very soon, but tickets don't go on sale for that until May. But San Diego, Seattle, you can get tickets and information at my website, romplacone.com. And yeah, please watch Left at Wall. And again, thanks so much for having me. It was a blast.
You've joined our short list of directors that we've had on like this year. It's Alex Cox, Adam McKay, and you as our
We've
also had Michael Lehman on in the past.
Yeah, well, I said that's why I said this year. Yeah, but
keep him busy.
That's yeah.
Christina, do you have anything to plug?
Well, I'm doing a Rio Vidal cosplay right now. I'm probably gonna do a little bit of a short stream after this. Yeah.
All right.
And what else do I have to plug? Nothing really.
All right. Well, we're gonna be doing the.
Did we just lose? Just at the very end. He just kinda... yeah.
It froze.
His internet was like, "You've had enough."
Yeah.
I'm back, right? I'm back.
Yeah, you're back. Yeah. You're back. You were gone for a minute. Yeah, you were definitely.
Yeah, I don't know. My internet. I mean, I'm happy my internet started acting up at the end of the stream and not like at the beginning. But yeah. So thanks so much for coming on, Ron.
Thanks so much for having me. This was awesome.
I enjoyed the movie. Watch Left at Wall for sure.